Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. This episode is about my recent field day, Renewable Energy for the Farm, Charcoal Production for Power and Fertility, where we covered three main topics, charcoal and biochar production, renewable energy, and woodlot management. I'll be getting into the details of the workshop, including the different kinds of charcoal and biochar production, using biochar to amend soil, charcoal for energy, managing a woodlot to meet a variety of needs in local and sustainable ways, wind down with some questions posted to Facebook that I didn't know where to put anywhere else, and wrap up with some updates. The Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture and Village Acres Farm made this field day possible. Before we begin, I'd like to share with you a little bit about both. The Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture, abbreviated by locals as PASA, was created in 1992 as a way to promote profitable farms that produce healthy food while respecting the natural environment. PASA is the largest statewide, member-based sustainable farming organization in the United States. This organization does a ton of good work in Pennsylvania with a variety of programs, but the two that have the most impact on me, and I think is of value to other permaculture practitioners, are the Farm-Based Education and the Farming for the Future Conference. The Farm-Based Education is how I went to the Energy for Your Farm event, and PASA holds these kinds of activities all the time. A few coming up as I write this are Forest Farming for Wild Edibles, Ramps, Nettles, Fiddleheads, and more, Animal Handling Workshop for New and Beginning Farmers, and another Renewable Energy for the Farm, this time focusing on microhydro. All of these have applications to people interested in permaculture and let you get out and see farms in operation. This last part matters because if you aren't farming or near a rural area, it's hard to get a grasp on the broad-scale picture. These events also let you network with people interested in sustainable practices. This is also where I encountered ideas such as mob grazing and some of the broader holistic farm management ideas, such as those that I spoke with Seth Wilner about several months ago. And all these ideas about learning and networking are at play with PASA's Farming for the Future conference. Held shortly after the new year, this conference condenses what you can do throughout the year via farm-based education into four amazing days of workshops, lectures, keynote speakers, and other events. You're likely to find someone who knows more about any particular interest you might have related to sustainable agriculture who's willing to share what they know. But neither of these resources would be available without the aid of the farmers who make it happen. For this most recent workshop, I was at Village Acres Farm, an organic operation in Mifflintown, Pennsylvania, run by Roy and Hope Brubaker. They recently transitioned into a partnership with Deborah, Roy's daughter, making this a multi-generational operation that is also intergenerational, as other family members own and operate additional farms that provide further products for their CSA, or community-supported agriculture. Another interesting aspect of the farm, and something I wouldn't have learned about without this experience, was their food shed. Though a simple name, the building that encapsulates it is a gorgeous timber-framed design with a radiant floor, passive solar lighting, and other energy-efficient and sustainable features. Here they serve food from the commercial kitchen and hold a variety of events. This is where we had lunch that day, and I was very thankful that the family members who served us were understanding of food allergies. Had I been able to stay around and take the farm tour after the workshop, I'd have a lot more to tell you about the farm. But because I couldn't, I'll include a link in the show notes if you'd like to check out the website and learn more. We're almost to the material for the workshop, but before I begin, remember, this show is listener-supported. Find out how to lend a hand by going to thepermaculturepodcast.com/support, and also like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast, or follow me on Twitter at permaculturecst. Now then, the field day. In covering this, I'm going to focus mostly on the question and answer material we covered during the class. I say this because charcoal and biochar production is something you should experience to get an understanding of. So give a listen, look at the pictures on the website, which those of you who follow the show on Facebook already had an opportunity to see. Check out some videos and sign up for a workshop. This is a great hands-on project for any gardener, farmer, or permaculture practitioner. The workshop I attended was taught by Gary Gilmore, a forester for the Pennsylvania Department of Conservation and Natural Resources, and, as someone identified him that day, a charvangelist. He's passionate about the possibilities of charcoal and biochar for a more productive, local, and thriving culture, so much so that it's almost infectious. His background, combined with the science involved from his current occupation, tied together such that this session was science and numbers heavy. I'm including the pieces I understood enough to write down, and will include everything that I can. I'm also putting links in the show notes to his YouTube videos so you can see him and more of this material for yourself. We began the day after introductions with charcoal and biochar production. So what is charcoal or biochar? Both are essentially the same thing, carbon along with some oxygen, hydrogen, and minerals, left over after burning a source material in a low oxygen or oxygen-free environment. They are very similar end products, and largely the distinction is in how we use them. Charcoal is larger and used primarily as fuel. If you think about lump charcoal, not briquettes, this is about what charcoal produced at home looks like when it first comes out of the kiln. Mr. Gilmore, during the second section of the class, showed us his grinder that he uses to make the charcoal a uniform size for gasification as part of the renewable energy portion of the class. Biochar, on the other hand, is very fine, to the point of resembling black dust or powder that is in turn used as a soil amendment by digging it into the garden. This fine material has a much, much larger surface area by volume, allowing for more nutrient holding, water retention, and the other benefits currently being researched. Though the terms can be used interchangeably, and I do throughout this conversation, remember that charcoal is for fuel, whereas biochar is used as a soil amendment. When producing charcoal or biochar, there are two different production methods, the direct or the indirect. Direct production is where you burn wood directly in order to produce charcoal. This can be done as simply as with two metal barrels, one on the bottom to hold the wood with holes near the bottom for the primary air intake, and another larger barrel on top acting as the afterburner to create cleaner combustion. This is known as a top-light updraft gasifier, or TLUD, T-L-U-D. As the fire is lit from the top and burns down, which causes gasification, and the gases rise up, the primary air from the holes in the bottom of the barrel allow the wood to burn in a controlled way, while secondary air coming through the crack between the two barrels where they meet is the secondary airflow that aids final combustion. This design is very, very clean burning. Once it got started, there was little to no visible smoke, but you could see the thermal updrafts coming off of it. All the demonstrations at this workshop were of this TLUD style of direct production. But the other side is indirect production, is what you might see where there's one barrel inside of another, or a specially built biochar kiln, where an external fire is applied to the kiln containing material to be converted into biochar. In this case, heat applied from the outside bakes the material inside, drives off the volatile gases, and turns it into charcoal. What do you want to use to make charcoal or biochar? Mr. Gilmore recommended making charcoal out of wood that had air dried for 1 year, which means it has about a 20% moisture content, considerably lower than fresh cut wood. This wood would come from the heart of the tree and not contain a great deal of bark, as bark contains minerals which lead to more ash. Instead, bark is excellent for biochar. Using indirect production, you can use just about any garden refuse you want because the process doesn't require the material being turned into biochar to fuel the process directly. Material with higher mineral content, such as wood bark or green plant material, work well in this case as the mineral content helps to build the soil. Another consideration, beyond just direct or indirect, is also the difference between high temperature and low temperature production. With high temperature, especially via the indirect method, you produce a higher quality charcoal useful for fuel because the pyrolysis drives off more of the oxygen, hydrogen, and other materials. High temperature production is not appropriate for use as biochar. Rather, we use low temperature production, which is in the 600 to 800 degree range, and produces a final product that is around 70% carbon, 30% other materials, and is good for both fuel or soil amendment. The direct method will use some of the source material as fuel, leaving you with around 60% of the starting weight in charcoal. The indirect method is more efficient for converting to charcoal, leaving you with around 70% of the starting weight, but requires external energy to produce, leading to a potentially less efficient system. I've seen indirect methods that cycle the volatile gases back into the firebox off of the kiln to help increase efficiency and decrease the amount of fuel. Time and tests will tell which works better, but to get you started, the direct method is great. I'm interested in biochar production as a way to turn multiflora rose and myla minute, two rather pernicious non-natives that quickly spread and smother out other vegetation, into something useful for my garden. In my interest to design myself out of the system, reducing them in my area is important, while my design establishes itself and can better minimize these kinds of rapidly spreading plants. How much charcoal can you get from your source material? I don't have numbers on garden waste because of how much this varies from plant to plant on the amount of moisture, how dry the stalks are, what the actual amount of dry material is between different plants, and so on. However, for wood, it's a little more straightforward, though of course your end results will vary, but you should wind up with about 40% by weight of what you started with. For those of you interested in the numbers, I came to this figure because Mr. Gilmore recommended using wood that had air dried for 1 year, which is about 20% moisture, then burned through direct production. Fresh wood is around 50% moisture, so if you start with 10 pounds of freshly cut wood, after 1 year you'll have 7 pounds ready to go in the kiln. You'll lose another 40% through pyrolysis, 20% being the moisture driven off, and then 20% being used as fuel, resulting in about 4 pounds of charcoal in the end. This is important to consider when you think about what you're going to be using to produce biochar to bury in the soil, or charcoal as fuel, that you will need a fair amount of material to start with to meet any planned final goals. Which brings us to charcoal, biochar, and climate change. When we hear conversations with people such as Connor Stedman or Eric Tonesmeyer about taking action to mitigate climate change with things like carbon farming and biochar, what role does our production of these materials play into that? Charcoal represents, to the best of my understanding, a carbon-neutral fuel source if, and that if is very important, we use well-managed woodlots and industrial waste, such as lumber mill refuse, to provide the base material in a way where we grow what we burn at an equal replacement rate, while using that material for both fuel and charcoal. For every pound of material harvested, we need to grow a pound to replace it. In this way, the wood takes carbon out of the air to grow, and then returns it when combusted. That's a simple recycling of material. Where this doesn't work is in using fossil fuels to burn material grown specifically for charcoal or biochar production. Where things get even more interesting is in the using of this biochar as a soil amendment. Carbon, in this form, is very, very stable in soils and can last for centuries. There's evidence that the terra preta from which the idea of biochar in the modern era arose, and you'll find terra preta in the tropical rainforests of South America, is pre-Columbian in nature and dates back over 1,000 years. And that's a long time to be locking carbon in the earth. According to Mr. Gilmore, for every pound of carbon sequestered in this way, we keep upwards of 3.5 pounds of CO2 from forming due to decay of the original material. And it's nice because it can be done on a home scale. However, and I hope this points to the question about whether or not this is really carbon negative, one raised by Brent Verrill on the Facebook page announcing this episode, is that the value Mr. Gilmore gave is correct about 1 pound, or 450 grams, of carbon sequestering around 3.5 pounds, or 1.66 kilograms, of eventual CO2. A figure confirmed by two friends of mine who know a lot more about chemistry than I do, but it's an ideal theoretical maximum conversion of carbon into CO2, which is not necessarily reflective of what actually happens through the biological cycling processes that lock up and then release carbon dioxide. So the actual ratio of sequestration is probably lower than that 1 to 3.5 figure. Also, as low-temperature biochar production results in a product that's around 70% carbon and 30% other materials, you'd need to bury 1.4 pounds of biochar to sequester that 3.5 pound ideal. And in creating biochar for it to be carbon negative, the inputs need to be small enough in carbon output relative to the storage potential so the inputs don't outweigh the sequestration value, which may be one of the issues of industrial versus small-scale production of biochar. When looking at fossil fuels and their production of carbon dioxide, gasoline releases around 19 pounds of CO2 per gallon burned, while diesel releases around 22 pounds. Using gasoline equivalence figures, natural gas requires around 128 cubic feet for the same amount of heat energy, measured in BTUs, as a gallon of gasoline, which releases around 15 pounds of CO2 in complete combustion, compared to bituminous coal, requiring around 10 pounds and releasing 28.6 pounds of carbon dioxide. So you can see that we would have to bury quite a lot of biochar to start looking at sequestering an amount of carbon equal to our production in Western society. But also, With all these numbers rolling around, you can see why using gasoline or diesel to transport the material to be used for production to a central location, then moving that final product out again to where it's used, and then using machinery to dig it in, can quickly deplete the benefits of burying biochar in the ground for sequestration on an industrial scale. Once you include fossil fuels to create this material, there's even greater loss of how much carbon is stored versus created. And though this was a quick shot that's number heavy, I was going to include a lot more of math here to break down how charcoal and biochar production converts between these different fuel sources, but I wasn't confident I had everything right. The few pieces I could find that gave numbers don't show the work from point A to B, and I don't want to extrapolate that. If someone knows the numbers behind how much energy is required to convert wood to charcoal, and can do a comparison between the different fuels, please let me know. But thankfully, biochar has other values to us when buried, beyond just carbon sequestration. So, what does biochar do when we add it to the soil? The reported benefits are many, and here's a short sampling. Enhances plant growth, suppresses methane emissions, reduces nitrous oxide emissions, reduces fertilizer requirements, and reduces leaching of nutrients. These last three, in particular, were of interest to Mr. Gilmore because of the impact they have on waterways regarding nutrient runoff. As I've mentioned before, reducing the daily total load from runoff into streams and rivers in my watershed is very important because of the impact it has on the Chesapeake Bay. Integrating biochar and reaping these benefits is one pathway to help reduce this runoff. And you can find out more at biochar.pbworks.com with a link included in the show notes. Two things you do need to do in order to use the biochar you produce. The first is to make sure it is a small size, like dust or grains of sand. This is where using garden waste for conversion comes in because grass and leaves are finer grain to begin with and powder readily. Whatever you need to do to get them to this point, go for it. I'm thinking my 3-year-old son in a butter churn filled with charcoal is the ideal way to reduce charcoal to powder, but I don't know how much my wife would like that or what kind of protective supplies he would need. But I just have this image of him going out with a little lab coat, an apron and a dust mask, goggles, and just coming in covered in charcoal and giggling the entire time. Mr. Gilmore, though, commented about mixing his charcoal with wood chips and spreading it over a section of his driveway so that as vehicles drove in and out, they would reduce it over time. They could just scoop it up and then add it to his garden. His current process, though, is to add the coarse charcoal to his horse stalls where the horses tramp it down and break it up and mix their urine and manure with the charcoal. And this leads to the second point recommended by both Mr. Gilmore and Dow Hendricks, another biochar enthusiast who attended the course to assist, and that's to charge the biochar. Charging is introducing an initial source of nutrients into the biochar before incorporating it into the soil. In addition to animal pens, there was a suggestion of adding biochar to a composting toilet in place of brown material, or as the main absorbent in a urine bucket, or to mix it with compost or compost tea. One thought Mr. Gilmore had, and I'm interested in experimenting with, or hearing from you if you've done so, is if you can use charged biochar directly as a growing medium, without any soil or other additives. Have you tried this? Let me know. That covers the first half of this episode. And now we can move on to the shorter sections, gasification for energy and cooking, and then woodlot management. After lunch, we talked about using charcoal as a fuel source. Opening this conversation, as you'll see in one of the pictures if you browse over to thepermaculturepodcast.com, Mr. Gilmore began by holding a can of gasoline in one hand and a bundle of wood in the other. These two fuels are roughly equivalent in heat energy. 1 gallon of gasoline to 25 pounds of air-dried, seasoned wood. If you burn wood directly, they're about equivalent. But you can also use the wood in a wood gas generator to create syngas, or synthetic gas, by using the pyrolysis method to generate charcoal and biochar to drive off the volatile gases in the wood, which an internal combustion engine can use directly with little to no modification. Another option is to create charcoal and use it for gasification into syngas to run an engine. Of these three methods, Mr. Gilmore prefers using charcoal for gasification because the charcoal gas generator system is less complicated than a wood gas generator and will still run an engine directly. Given a lot of the technical aspects of these systems, I don't want to get into the full details of the differences between the two. But what I can say is that the benefits of a wood gas generator is that it is more efficient in time because you don't need to convert your fuel from wood into charcoal. and more efficient in generating gas because you don't lose the 20% or so you would in burning the wood to charcoal. However, the wood gas generator is more complicated because you need to include traps in the system for moisture being driven off, as well as the ash, tar, and other materials that can gum up or degrade an engine. Also, because of inconsistencies between outputs from various woods, you also need a way to control the gas flow into the engine. If you want to learn more about wood gasification, there are websites devoted to it, and there is also a book recommended during the workshop called Have Wood, Will Travel, written by Wayne Keith. You can buy it directly from Wayne at his website, driveonwood.com, for the price of $50. Seeing what Mr. Wayne is doing by driving with wood gas already has my mind turning for other down-the-road projects. If you're someone out there already doing gasification like this, please let me know. I'd like to hear more from you. But what I got to see the day of the workshop was Mr. Gilmore's functioning charcoal gasifier, which he ran to show us that, yes, this does work, and how everything was set up. The basis of the system was a metal barrel to burn the charcoal in, with an air inlet consisting of a piece of 1-inch threaded pipe, which I believe was stainless steel, going through a homemade bulkhead into the barrel, about a quarter of the way up from the bottom. Attached to the outside of this pipe was a valve. On the inside, the pipe was covered by a larger piece of iron pipe with about a quarter of its circumference removed, lengthwise, to create a shield to cover the inlet. Charcoal was then added on top and shaken down into the bottom around the air inlet. The lid is then added, which has an outlet that attached to a piece of plastic tube that runs to a filter can. Inside the filter can, from top to bottom, is a piece of wool fabric sewn to a metal wire shaped to fit the top of the can fairly tightly. Beneath this is a thick section of open cell rubber foam, and beneath that, wool fabric scraps. Mr. Gilmore uses wool as part of his filter, based on some research he read from Australian charcoal gasifiers that wool is one of the better natural filters. The filter can then connects by more tubing to an electric fan that creates a draw to move the gas from the gasifier through the filter to the engine, where the tubing from the fan runs directly into the carburetor for uptake by the engine. The exhaust from the engine is then routed back to a valve connected to the inlet, so some of the exhaust gases can be recycled, producing cleaner combustion. The valve there allows for control of this gas flow being recycled to control the combustion temperature, as the exhaust gases are hotter than the charcoal gas being generated. From there, the final gases run out through a combined radiator and exhaust. One note here is that the charcoal gas for most of the burn is fairly cool, under 120 degrees. The piece of plastic pipe Mr. Gilmore uses to connect the gasification barrel to the filter is one of his fail-safes, because it melts at 120 degrees. If something happens that the system temperature rises too much, this pipe fails and prevents damage to the other components. Once Mr. Gilmore walked us through the setup and had everything connected, he lit it through the inlet pipe near the bottom of the charcoal barrel. Within maybe a few minutes of lighting the system, he was able to start the gasoline engine on the charcoal gas and allowed it to run for 15 or 20 minutes while we talked about and explored how it worked. The engine attached to the system was a standard, unmodified, 10-horsepower gasoline engine. Using charcoal gas, the system produces around 8 horsepower, because charcoal gas is less energetic than gasoline, with a resulting loss of around 20 to 25%. He estimates he could run this engine for about an hour to an hour and a half on around 6 pounds of charcoal, or about a third of the barrel, whereas he has a larger 25-horsepower engine, with a resulting 20-horsepower output, that runs for about 30 minutes on the same amount of fuel. All off of the basic system, he showed us, with a 1-inch inlet and outlet for air and gas flow. He thinks that a 25-horsepower base engine is about the limit for this setup with a 1-inch flow, but that by increasing the inlet and outlet size, it scales up easily, with a similar increase in fuel consumption as well. So you'll need to include a larger gasifier unit, filter, fan, and so on, as things get larger. What really got me about this system is the potential to do real work with unmodified or lightly modified existing machinery without fossil fuels. These aren't novelty approaches, as was reinforced by Mr. Gilmore talking about running his 25-horsepower walk-behind tractor on charcoal gas, and he even ran a vintage air-cooled Volkswagen Beetle on it, traveling about 11 miles in his tests. That's one side. The other is that this can be used to generate electricity, as we saw from a pair of lights attached to and run off of the charcoal gas demonstration system. This small-scale portable solution could be used now in emergencies, or in off-the-grid arrangements as backup to solar and wind, or as a possible long-term solution for local generation of power. I think about all these battery-powered devices that we currently use in civilization with laptops and cell phones and everything else, where a small charcoal or wood gas engine set up to some kind of a generator could produce the power for yourself and your neighbors to keep these kinds of devices running. Also, as was stated several times during the workshop, cool and cold weather is the time to produce charcoal and biochar from the previous year's brush and scrap wood. So you could potentially build a charcoal kiln as a heater, so as not to let all that energy go to waste. Creativity with good design leads to many, many yields in this system. One participant at the workshop commented about using the exhaust from a gasifier to warm and elevate the CO2 levels in a greenhouse. I'm sure there would be safety measures in place, so as not to cause any issues due to carbon monoxide or other gases in the exhaust. I think it's an interesting possibility. This is also where the warning goes. Making one of these systems is not inherently dangerous, but there are risks involved. If you don't feel comfortable with something, don't do it. Work with someone who has more experience to build or design your solution and learn to operate it safely. And I'm also not going to argue that these are the most efficient systems around by any means for producing useful work, creating electricity, or the time required to do so, but they remain options that can make a difference for the choices we make in our desire to build a better world. It's not about a one-size-fits-all solution for everyone, but a series of options to use where appropriate to build more flexible alternatives. That also goes for another use of gasification, which was a T-LUD stove design Mr. Dale Hendricks shared with us that day. The particular stove he brought, which you can see pictures of in the show notes, is called a Champion T-LUD, and is based on an award-winning design for a cleaner-burning stove competition. The idea behind this is the same as the wood gasification for charcoal production, and the stove even produces a small quantity of charcoal, except in this case, applying the design to a small scale for cooking. The note here is that if you use this type of stove to cook and produce charcoal, you'll want a bucket of water several times the size of your stove, with water in it to quench the charcoal in when you're done cooking. A handle on the stove to lift and move it probably helps too. In his demonstration, Mr. Hendricks used compressed hardwood pellets for fuel, and I thought it was a simple way to use pellets that might have been damaged by moisture and no longer usable in a regular wood pellet stove, and in turn could be had cheaply. I say this because I have several bags sitting around at the moment a friend gave me after their basement had some water in it. And so a T-LUD stove like this fits easily in my thoughts. And this stove is another option to include for emergencies or potentially to replace other forms of stoves in off-the-grid or no-grid situations. There's plenty of information available on how to build your own if you are interested, with links in the resource sections of the show notes, as well as people making them for purchase. Consider experimenting with this and adding your experiences to the growing pool of knowledge on these simple yet revolutionary systems. That brings us to the final part of the workshop material, which was woodlot management. Being a forester by training, Mr. Gilmore shared with us how to apply the way a forester thinks with our production of charcoal and biochar. To that end, we started with a conversation about invasive species that kill trees, such as the emerald ash borer here in Pennsylvania and other parts of the United States. Knowing your local area and what threats there are to your trees let you make choices. If a tree is highly likely to be killed, you can harvest it before that happens and make use of what you can, or be prepared to cut it down when it does die and know what you'll do under the new conditions. From that introduction, we walked into a woodlot at Village Acres Farm and began by looking up at the canopy or overstory trees to see which ones had won the war for sunlight. Mr. Gilmore pointed out that the losers in this competition could be selectively harvested to open up more of the canopy, to allow succession to begin in that spot, and use the removed tree for charcoal production or some other means. But before making that choice after looking up, we looked around to identify trees that were there, to see which ones are rare, so should be preserved. Which ones are unique for some reason, such as trees having unique or pleasant form? Which ones you might consider invasive and want to remove, or which ones might be valuable for composting? Using that information, then making decisions on which to keep and which to remove based on your overall site plan and usage patterns. As you make these decisions and decide on what you want to remove, be sure you don't mine the woods for resources, because then a process that could be sustainable becomes extractive. Rather, make the choices so that you can regenerate the forest as you make use of it. One point Mr. Gilmore made was to not remove the down woody material on the forest floor. The twigs, sticks, and limbs we find resting against the soil play an important role in maintaining soil fertility and supporting fungi, so it should be left. I was given the impression that selectively removing and using trees had a lower impact on the forest ecology and scavenging for what can be found on the forest floor. And going back to the invasive or non-native or exotic plants, thought for a moment. I'm of a mind that removing some of the more pernicious ones to your area to help re-establish succession of local woodlands is important, and also provide a resource for biochar production through the indirect method that could be quite useful for soil amending while leaving trees and other dense woody material in place. I know the native versus non-native, native versus invasive, native versus exotic conversation is still open to a lot of debate, and one will keep circling for a while. For me, however, thinking about the problem as the solution, and in turn obtaining a yield, converting this material that I don't want into something I do plays a role in my long-term strategy. And since I mentioned the word of a hot subject, we did touch on coppicing. But by this point in the day, information was tossed around quicker than I could make notes. Here's what I did pick up. In Pennsylvania and other northern hemisphere cool temperate climates, the time to coppice trees is during the plant's dormant period, which is the months of R: January, February, March, April, September, October, November, December. That evergreens like pine or hemlock do not coppice well. However, deciduous trees generally do. Deciduous trees should be ones that do not form root suckers, such as locust or aspen. There were also some comments that beech and birch do not coppice well, but I didn't note why. Trees mentioned that do coppice well were maple, oak, ash, willow, hickory, black walnut, hazel, and Chinese chestnut. And the method for coppicing is to cut the tree down to a stump, nearly at ground level, perhaps a few inches high, and at an angle to allow water to run off and not cause the stump to rot. This then forms a new crown that additional growth occurs from. And that little bit on coppicing wrapped up the conversation for the day and brought the workshop to a close. We walked out of the woodlot, said our goodbyes, and went about our separate ways. And though that brought the workshop to an end, there is still some more for this episode. Now then, the listener questions submitted by Brent via the Facebook page. I would like to understand more about why hugel culture is more highly recommended for colder climates, while biochar is recommended for warmer climates. I understand why you might not want to bury wood in tropical areas, because there is no cold cycle, bacterial and fungal action are amped up in tropical soils and break down all organic matter faster. But I don't see why biochar wouldn't work as well in colder climates as it does in warmer ones, perhaps even in conjunction with wood. To the question specifically regarding non-tropical regions, biochar works, and there's no reason not to implement it as part of your overall strategy where appropriate. Using the permaculture zone model, I wouldn't dig it into zones 3, 4, or 5, but would certainly include it when digging the holes for trees and shrubs for planting, and also incorporate it fully in gardens and production beds in zones 1 and 2. Or in any container plants that I'm growing in zone 0. More broadly, though, I think what's going on with hugel culture compared to biochar is that hugel culture is more widely understood as a technique and less intensive to implement, while still providing benefits such as a raised bed, improving the garden conditions, and building the soil. Though you can dig a trench to bury the woody material in for the bed, it isn't necessary. You can pile it all in place, dump soil and compost on it, mulch it, let it age if so inclined, and eventually plant in it. And, I mean, I like hugel culture because my children and I can collect the material and put it in one place while playing in the yard, or begin building a new bed if we find things without having to complete it all at once. I can just put the sticks there when I have the time, if I have a half an hour or hour to walk around the yard, and then later add my soil and compost, and then later go out and mulch it, and do the production over time. Hugel culture can also be taught in an hour or two, and people can go home and start using it right away. Biochar, on the other hand, takes time to gather the materials. If you're going to be producing charcoal with wood, then you need to be seasoning that wood to lower the moisture content. You need some equipment to create it in, even if it's just a pair of metal barrels, and then remain with it to manage the burn. Yes, you can do some other things while it's burning, but you need to remain with it on fire watch. Once done, you then need to reduce it to a powder and charge it, and then dig it into the A and B horizons of the soil. And this is considerably more work than hugel culture, and limits implementation on a broader scale. There's also a question about whether or not biochar is truly carbon negative, which I think I handled to some degree earlier. If you'd like more research and contemplation on that, please let me know, and I can work something up with more detail. His final question is, I wonder about the wisdom of single-purpose biochar kilns. I see things on the internet, YouTube videos, instructables, even products you can buy, and most especially kilns that charities are making for developing countries, and I cringe. All that energy that could have been useful for something is wasted to make biochar. Biochar is great and all, but wouldn't it make sense to make use of all that heat? And I agree with you on the idea of searching for more solutions and ways we can use that heat. But from the designs I've seen of single-purpose biochar kilns, they're a potentially an efficient way to convert non-woody material like grass, dry leaves, or end-of-season plant stalks and so on into biochar, because they're usually an indirect means of production, with a sealed chamber heated by an external source, allowing the moisture in the plant material to be cooked off and then converting what's left into charcoal in a controlled way, something that isn't as easy to do with this finer material in a direct system, and again allows the ash and mineral content contained within to be collected and to build soil. And there's also less management of this kind of biochar kiln, having to watch it and learn some of the art of creating biochar. You can just kind of start your fire underneath of it and produce something that's going to be useful. But that goes back to one thing that Mr. Gilmore and Mr. Hendricks mentioned several times during the workshop. Charcoal and biochar production is based on ancient systems that we're rediscovering in the modern era. That leads me to think about charcoal and biochar production in that it isn't hard. But where the difficulty rests is when we start thinking about how to use all of our knowledge in the current age and these big brains of ours to eke out the widest range of yields for the system, like the most efficient kilns, or determining which biochar is most effective for soil building. The designs that exist at this moment, to me, represent some of the earliest, simplest options we've come up with as we figure out all the little interconnected pieces about how to produce this material. As our designs advance and our knowledge grows, while we continue to learn, over time we should be able to produce more with less and increase the benefits from all the possibilities. Or at least, that's my thought on it right now. What's yours? I'd love to hear from you. If you have a comment or question about this show, a guest request, or want me to cover a particular topic, please feel free to contact me through any of the many ways available. Email show@thepermaculturepodcast.com. Phone 717-827-6266, a direct message on Twitter @permaculturecst. You can send me a message or a post on the wall at Facebook, facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast, or leave a comment in the notes for any episode. I'll get all of those and respond to you as quickly as I can. And last for this show, the updates. The end of my first semester of graduate school, which has made me rather busy through the close of April and into these next few weeks, is coming to a close. And with that leads to a more open schedule through the end of May, June, July, and August to continue producing new episodes and interview more folks, and also to launch the online PDC. All of that's moving ahead nicely, and public registration for that course is going to open in June. If you're interested, please let me know so I can send you a link to register if there are still seats available, as this is a first-come, first-enrolled course limited to 15 students. There's been enough interest so far that those are likely to fill up, but I'd like to be able to put you on the waiting list if you're interested in taking one of these classes. Also, this being spring in the Northern Hemisphere, my farming guests are quite busy with their planting and first harvests, so we're scheduling things out a month or so in advance with guests in the pipeline. As those get recorded for posting, I'll include them in future updates so you know who to expect next. And that brings this all to a close. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other.